Benvenuti al Politecnico di Torino per l'inaugurazione di Biennale Tecnologie 2022, la terza edizione. Grazie. Prima di tutto vi ringrazio davvero perché questa partecipazione così ricca, vedere questa sala completamente esaurita, ci dà davvero il lancio per partire con entusiasmo e fiducia a percorrere queste giornate così ricche. E la nostra serata si svilupperà con questa lezione magistrale del nostro ospite d'onore, il professor Taleb, che ringrazio tantissimo per la disponibilità a raggiungere Torino e a seguire e a intervenire a Biennale Tecnologia. E proseguirà poi alla fine della sua lezione con un dialogo con il direttore della stampa Massimo Giannini. Ma per cominciare e dare davvero il via formale a questa nostra edizione, invito il rettore Guido Saracco, che è anche presidente di Biennale Tecnologia.
Io faccio un lavoro splendido che mi ha consentito di, tra le tante cose, questa è una delle più care, introdurre questa nuova modalità di fare università, fare terza missione, coinvolgere la cittadinanza, la società intera. Perché lo stiamo facendo ormai da qualche anno? Perché senza la consapevolezza della gente comune, in un paese democratico come il nostro, in primis, è impensabile intraprendere compiutamente, affidabilmente, quel cambiamento che ormai è ineludibile per rispondere in modo non solo più resiliente, ma più antifragile, come ci insegnerà Nassim. L'emozione è la stessa che c'era ormai 3 anni fa, quando abbiamo lanciato per il 160° anniversario della nascita del Politecnico di Torino il Festival della Tecnologia, ma poi subito abbiamo deciso di fare il sistema e di diventare Biennale Tecnologia, richiamando la Biennale Democrazia, che già da qualche edizione, dovrebbe essere la prossima, l'ottava se non vado errato, riempiva questa città per portare la popolazione a riflettere su la forma di governo che vogliamo e dobbiamo darci. Il Festival dell'Economia è poi arrivato l'anno scorso a completare un quadro in questa città. Il Festival dell'Economia ha una storia ancora più gloriosa, con una terza occasione di riflessione con la cittadinanza, con la società, sulla economia, lo sviluppo economico. Ed ecco allora che, se ci ricordiamo di quella che era la strategia di Lisbona, quello che si diceva all'inizio di questo secolo, cioè che l'innovazione oramai doveva nascere da una profonda collaborazione tra quelle che sono le 3 pale dell'elica dell'innovazione, ossia l'università e la ricerca, l'industria, l'economia e la politica, ecco che questa tripla elica in questa città si è arricchita di momenti di riflessione, in cui far crescere e maturare pensiero critico, sensibilizzare la popolazione su queste 3 dimensioni. Per questo ho condiviso con coloro che curano le altre 2 manifestazioni a cui ho accennato la convinzione che Torino si stia candidando come capitale del pensiero critico. Torino veramente sta diventando un laboratorio nazionale di progettazione del nostro futuro. E la gente di Torino, non dimentichiamoci che una parte importantissima è fatta da studenti universitari, ormai oltre il 15%, ma contrariamente al resto d'Italia questa città ha avuto una crescita ulteriore. Abbiamo letto recentemente del fatto che c'è stato un calo di studenti in Italia nell'università del 3%, qui siamo andati in controtendenza, abbiamo continuato a crescere e così sarà sempre. Gli studenti, amo sempre dire, portano con sé anche etica e portano con sé anche valori. Sono un elemento di rigenerazione urbana anche loro. La gente è sempre più curiosa, si appassiona, e lo vediamo anche oggi, di tematiche che un tempo pensavamo non dovessero essere, certamente non i panel e circense. Mi hanno fermato alcuni dicendomi nei giorni scorsi: professore, io devo proprio ringraziare. Io pensavo, ma sì, sono un po' di anni che ci diamo dentro, per carità. No, ma la devo ringraziare perché lei ha portato Taleb a Torino. Ho detto, guardi che Taleb io l'ho usato col suo pensiero nell'ultima inaugurazione dell'anno accademico, qualcuno era con noi di voi allora, e l'antifragilità, il reagire alle batoste, ne è arrivata ancora una nel frattempo, questa guerra in Ucraina, cioè dopo le batoste diventare più forti di prima è un qualcosa di estremamente interessante, no? Su cui riflettere. E pochi minuti fa, per dirvi anche dello spessore e della simpatia della persona, abbiamo rivisto dei pezzi di quell'inaugurazione, del video che c'è su YouTube con Nassim Taleb, e lui mi guardava: ah sì, hai fatto vedere quello, grazie. Come grazie? Io che devo ringraziare te che hai iniziato questa linea di pensiero che affascina così tante persone, su cui oltre alla sua lezione avremo poi possibilità più tardi di sentire un dibattito col direttore della stampa Giannini, che ho visto, a cui do il benvenuto. Bene, parte questa avventura, quella che ho definito con i miei colleghi la nostra festa, perché di fatto questa è la grande festa del Politecnico di Torino, una festa in cui noi ci apriamo alla società per portare conoscenza e per far riflettere la società, ma ci apriamo alla società anche perché abbiamo bisogno della società per essere un'università migliore. È impensabile che noi si possa continuare a fare formazione e ricerca come l'abbiamo fatta in passato, chiusi in una Turriseburnea, dove ci si chiedeva solamente di sdoganare quelli che io definivo dei semilavorati, cioè degli ingegneri ben squadrati che poi ci pensavano le imprese a farli diventare delle macchine da guerra nella vita reale. È impensabile continuare in questo modo. Oramai i lavori cambiano con un ritmo incessante. Se io non cambio, non coprogetto con le imprese, con gli enti territoriali, i miei progetti formativi, i ragazzi entrano in un tunnel, dopo 5 anni escono e gli chiedono delle cose che non capiscono. Recentemente mi hanno detto, questo capita in Israele, ma sai, oggi le università devono insegnare ai loro studenti a inventarsi il lavoro che faranno. Io la trovo una definizione splendida, è la versione 5.0 del Politecnico che abbiamo cercato di creare in questi anni, contaminandoci con le scienze dell'uomo e della società, promuovendo una didattica incentrata sugli studenti, nella ricerca facendo laboratori interdisciplinari che rispondono a esigenze dell'umanità, spesso anche facendo dei laboratori assieme a imprese coprogettati. Bene, pronti per il Politecnico 5.0, che non starà a me probabilmente progettare e varare, consci di dover accettare il cambiamento e cavalcarlo e di dover sensibilizzare la società a non avere paura del cambiamento e avere fiducia di un uso utile e indirizzato al bene comune delle tecnologie, che do ufficialmente il via alla Biennale Tecnologia 2022 e chiamo sul palco uno dei due curatori, il dottor De Biase. Grazie.
Bene, il punto è questo: seguire esattamente, conoscere bene Nassim Taleb e cercare di introdurlo bene è complesso, come la materia che lui ha affrontato, ha deciso di affrontare con la sua esperienza di professionista e con la sua esperienza di intellettuale. Lui parla del rischio, parla delle probabilità, parla di quello che può succedere, e in molte delle sue pubblicazioni si fa seguire attraverso narrazioni che si mescolano insieme alle parti saggistiche, analitiche. I personaggi dei suoi saggi sono quasi degli amici alla fine, quando voi avete seguito i suoi libri. Il più famoso naturalmente è Il Cigno Nero, che racconta di come sia importante ricordarci sempre che ogni nostra teoria può e sarà quasi certamente smentita da qualche fatto. Anzi, teoricamente è proprio così che noi pensiamo. Noi non possiamo pensare epistemologicamente di sapere la verità, ma sappiamo qualche cosa, una teoria che non è ancora stata sconfermata. Il Cigno Nero era uno degli esempi che ha fatto anche Karl Popper nel suo raccontare questo aspetto della epistemologia, cioè della filosofia, di come noi conosciamo e come conosciamo scientificamente. Quindi c'è una consapevolezza del fatto che più la teoria è rigida, più catastrofico sarà scoprire che era stata smentita da un fatto. Ci sono due grandi mondi nel mondo di Taleb: il mediocristan e l'estremistan. Il mediocristan è quello nel quale tutti i fenomeni sono più o meno intorno alla media e un caso estremo non modifica di molto la realtà. Per esempio, se noi prendiamo tutte le persone e gli facciamo, misuriamo l'altezza, vedremo che anche se c'è uno alto 3,5 metri, la media delle persone rimarrà più o meno simile. Mentre invece, per esempio, in finanza le cose cambiano profondamente. Siamo nell'estremistan: 10 grandi personaggi possiedono una ricchezza che è pari all'altra metà dell'umanità. Quindi quando nasce un nuovo caso di straricco come quelli che noi conosciamo, quello sposta la media. E quindi la regola, la descrizione del mondo dell'estremistan è, come voi Politecnico mi insegnate, la power law, quella che si concentra sugli estremi, mentre nella mediocristan tutto si concentra sulla gaussiana. Ora, tutto questo ci insegna a vivere in mezzo all'imprevedibile e a tener presente che le nostre conoscenze vanno messe in discussione, non sono la base per conoscere il futuro. Anzi, guardare al futuro come se fosse un tunnel che ha la luce in fondo è tipicamente un modo fragile di affrontare la questione. Dunque, per andare subito verso le conclusioni e saltare la parte in mezzo che mi ero immaginato di raccontarvi, la domanda è: ma il Covid era un cigno nero oppure no? E tutto ciò che ci è portato dietro, le scoperte, le conoscenze che abbiamo fatto, sono state tali da renderci più forti o più deboli? L'idea per rispondere ce la dà uno degli esempi famosi di Taleb. Lui dice: avete presente il tacchino? Il tacchino, nella sua vita e dal suo punto di vista, pensa che gli umani siano i suoi benefattori. È convinto che per tutta la sua vita questi umani lo nutrono, lo ingrassano, lo fanno stare bene, lo rilassano, gli fanno tutto quello che gli serve per stare bene, e quindi l'ultimo giorno, quando si presenta il macellaio per fare quello che deve fare, è un cigno nero. Ma per il macellaio non lo è. Ora, il Covid era un cigno nero o no? Per chi conosce la storia delle pandemie sa che non lo era. Per tutti gli altri forse lo è stato. Tanto è vero che il presidente della Cina, Xi Jinping, ha pensato di citare Taleb per spiegare la storia del Covid in Cina. e da quel momento il libro di Taleb è partito e si vende in Cina più che in tutto il resto del mondo, e l'anno prossimo si prevede avrà superato le vendite di tutti gli, di tutti gli altri paesi occidentali. Ora vediamo che cosa ci racconterà sul Covid, i vaccini e l'esperienza che ha fatto per valutare il rischio in quella circostanza Nassim Taleb.
Sono molto onorato di essere qui. Apologize, scusi, but I have to speak in English because, unfortunately, that's how it works. But over time, my Italian improved a bit, but it's so I can understand. But I make mistakes when I speak, and it's embarrassing for Politecnico for me to come and make grammatical mistakes. So this is why I've elected to speak in English. I thank the people who were here to talk about the climate, because I'm going to use that example to summarize the Incerto. Incerto has 5 volumes. The Black Swan is one of them, but Antifragile is one of them. So if I were to summarize the Incerto, it took me a while to summarize it. It's the following point. The more uncertainty in the system, the easier the decision. Okay, so let's use this very simple example. My friend here, Luca, you're going to fly to Rome, so you go to the airport, Torino airport, and they tell you, we have uncertainty about the skills of the pilot. We're not certain. I mean, some people say he's very good, but he or she is very good, but we're not certain. What do? You take the train, you swim, you ride a bicycle even, right? You can even walk to Rome, but you're not gonna get on that plane. So when people come and tell me we have uncertainty about climate models, what do I do? Same thing, uncertainty about climate models, I want out of that trade, so don't pollute. Simple. So I have uncertainty about the water. Okay. Sorry, incidentally, there's water. So I have uncertainty about the water. What do I do? Simple decision. So I don't drink it. Okay. So the more uncertainty in the system, the easier decision. That's how I can summarize the Incerto. So now let's talk about COVID. Talk about the mistakes. I don't know how many mistakes there are, about 7 or 8. I'm gonna stop maybe at number 4 or 5, depends on how things go, all right? We have a discussion after that. So, by the way, where's this water from? Okay, so.
Not sure.
So, I'll start with the first mistake. The first problem, the process has a fat tail, coda grassa, or you can say coda larga, or coda lunga, coda whatever. Okay, so long tail, fat tail. But what do I mean by this? This actually was discovered by Pareto here. And I mean, he didn't live in Italy. I don't have his picture, but I can show you his picture before and after he discovered it. He aged a lot, and his wife left him in between for his driver. So you can figure out that it's not a good idea to work on statistical distributions. But now if I look at, this is the technical part. Everything in yellow is what you study in school, including Politecnico. And everything in white is what you don't study in school. But here, this is in Italian as spoken in New York. Forget about it, all right? It means, hey, don't get on that train. So we're gonna link this to COVID and the mistakes. It's not gonna be technical. It's only technical in the beginning to just wake people up, you know, get off their Twitter and social media to focus a little. But everything is summarized in this book, Statistical Consequences of Fat Tail. Chapter 3 is the only readable one. The rest completely, you know, you can't read it. It's too opaque, too many equations, theorems, but it's pretty much a backup for the Black Swan, about 20 scientific papers around that program of fat tails. Now, what is the problem of fat tails? Every economist would tell you, of course we know about fat tails. My answer is, no, you don't know about fat tails. It's not a matter of saying, oh, we know about it. It's everything you do, and that was a program in statistical consequences of fat tails, is all your statistical estimators have to be changed, all your empiricism has to be changed, all your decision making has to be changed. So, let me now introduce a problem as presented by a fellow in insurance, Cramer. He was not Italian, but the big guys usually are Italian, and you know, De Firetti stuff, but he happened to be Swedish. It's okay, right? I apologize. So there is a difference between Mediocristan and Extremistan expressed as follow. You sample randomly and you get two persons with a total height of 4.1 meters, okay? Big, you know, interesting sample. You have an outlier. What's more likely? What's the most likely combination? 10 centimeters and 4 meters? No, what's the most likely? 20 centimeters and, what is the most likely? 205, no? So conditional having a large deviation for a total of two events, for the sum of two events, it came from two large events. So in other words, it's much easier in Mediocristan to have two 3-sigma events than one 6-sigma event. Okay? This is the basis behind insurance. Conditional on losing a lot of money, you didn't lose it on one single event, but on many events. Okay? That's Mediocristan. So in other words, you can diversify your risk. No single event will hit you in a big way. Now, same thought experiment. You randomly select two people, and their total combined net worth is $36 million. 36? I didn't index for inflation, but you use, okay. So, what is the most likely combination? 18 and 18? No. 36 and zero, or 36 minus $1 and $1, okay? So, the difference between these two domains, the difference between these two domains is that in one, things come, it's more likely, you know, to have, if you get in trouble, it's more likely to come for a lot of events. And the second one, one shock. We'll see more what this is all about, but that explains the demarcation. You either have one or the other. My total calorie consumption, if I consume 1 million calories over a year, is probably gonna come at 3,000 a day or something. It's not gonna be zero and then a million. But you can easily, if you lose $1 million in a year, it's not gonna be $3,000 a day. It's more likely to come from one day. Okay? So that's the difference. Unfortunately, I can't lose weight. I wish I could lose 20 kilos or 10 kilos in one day. I can't, all right? But you can lose all your money in one event. A day like yesterday, for example, is a simple example. So, now, fattest tails with a fellow who's Italian, Pasquale Cirillo, we worked on pandemics and wars. These are, so forget about the math, and now when I say fat tails, it means that typically everything comes from one person. If we gather randomly people in a room, odds are one person will have, according to Pareto, probably more than half the net worth. So, inflation, earthquakes, energy released by earthquakes, technology companies, size of cities. So to give you an example, one in 25,000 companies in California in the 90s, technology companies, had half, one per 25,000 had half the revenues, okay? So they have domains where things have concentration. So things in terms of fat tail, in terms of concentration. So, and then we worked on when COVID started, nobody was interested in our work on wars and pandemics. And then suddenly, of course, it is a tail event. So, and the mechanism by which these things happen is that you have to have multiplication. To give you an idea of what has winner-take-all events and what doesn't have winner-take-all events, if I'm an author, I just write a book, and every time someone buys a Chino Nero, I don't have to go back and write it. But if I were a dentist or a brain surgeon, you can't just do it once and go home and go retire in Tuscany and do bicycle around Tuscany, or so. You can't. So we have deliver every time. So we have two kind of businesses. The scalable is likely to lead to concentration, and the non-scalable is likely to be democratic, sort of. The income, the difference between dentists is small. The difference between opera singers is huge. At some point, 10 opera singers made almost all the money, and that came from globalization. So globalization causes concentration. Now, in the Black Swan, Chino Nero, which came out in 2007, I explained that as we have more connectivity on the planet, things are more scalable, and of course, in a strange acute virus spreading throughout the planet, it's obvious, and actually we're gonna see that the real Chino Nero, for those inside, on the inside, is that it didn't happen before. That's more of a Chino Nero, because we're very connected. So, to give you a simple example, you remember, your ancestors probably those survived a certain event. About a third of Europe died, came via Constantinople, or at a time, or other cities. The traveling at 20 kilometers a day, maximum speed. Today, a single conference in Las Vegas can gather 30,000 doctors coming from more than 100 countries and redistribute the virus worldwide in a single week. So, and so it took something like 300 to 400 years for the Great Plague to reach some villages in England. Now it's no longer possible. We're too connected, so things will spread much faster than before. It's not bad news if you know it. It is, of course, bad news if you don't know it. And let's look at the first mistake. The first mistake, what I call fake empiricism, is committed by this fellow, who's Dr. Phil, is a TV fellow, but it's also committed, it's committed by a lot of people. I don't know if you know the Steven Pinker, a big professor at Harvard, all these guys make the mistake. Everything in the financia comportamentale, behavioral finance, comportamentale, is plagued with that mistake. We're gonna see how. So let's see how we can compare the mistakes of using variables, comparing variables from mediocre stand with extremist stand. The fellow here was saying that we don't close down the country because of people drowning in their swimming pool, okay? So therefore, why are we worried about COVID? That was in March when we had only 3,000 deaths from COVID, and about 3,000 deaths from people drowning in their swimming pool over the previous 12 months. So my answer is simple, by saying that if I drown in my swimming pool, my neighbor is no more likely to drown in her or his swimming pool. But if I die of COVID, the odds of my neighbor dying of COVID has increased. So we can't compare these random multiplicative random variables to scalable multiplicative random variables to ones that are from Mediocristan. How many people drown in a swimming pool, how many heart attacks, how many car accidents, how many women killed by I don't know, falling from ladders, how many twins, you know, dying in the same car accident. All these things are from Mediocristan. So, but this is committed by, you know, very serious, like The Economist, during Ebola, we were fighting, a group of friends and myself, to try to explain that you cannot compare. They were saying, oh, Ebola killed very few people, why are you worried? Well, Ebola spreads, the others don't spread. They couldn't get the point of the difference between multiplicative and non-multiplicative. But now, the fact that The Economist makes that mistake is serious. Vastly more serious is that these psychologists of decision-making make the same mistake, where they say, okay, this is a statistical frequency as estimated, and this is the perception. I don't know, one of them is perception, one of them is reality. And they tell you, well, people are making a mistake because they're overestimating or underestimating some risks. They don't get it. You don't compare these risks. And if you're using our worry about COVID, would put you off the charts. COVID had killed only a few thousand people, and we were worried about it. Ebola killed only 3 people in the United States, or maybe 2 people. Yeah, we're worried about it. So is it irrational? No, they are irrational. So psychologists are using the wrong model, therefore they are irrational. So this is my first mistake, is mistaking Mediocristan for Extremistan. Next, 2 fallacies of aggregation. How you go from this complex system, everybody knows how things scale and become different. So more is different. So you can't, it's not additive. We're gonna see how. So let me explain the following. In February 2020, if you look at the probability of a person dying in a car accident, is gonna be higher than the probability of someone dying from COVID for one person. But the inequality reverses when you talk about 1,000 people. So for one person, this probability is higher. For 1,000,000 people, the probability is lower. So let me play a thought experiment. Let's say, I know you've heard of Elon Musk, he wants us to go to Mars or somewhere. So let's say that you take a trip on one of his ships, you go to Mars, and they don't have internet connections in Mars. Okay? Nice thought experiment. You go there, you spend about a year in Mars, and then the only piece of news you get is that 800 million people died. Okay? What is it more likely to come from, car accidents or COVID? Conditional on a large event, you know it came from a different, from Extremistan. Conditional on a large deviation, you know where it came from. This is how you play risk, how you look at tail risk. So Professor Cirillo and myself, we're working in something we call extreme deviations, the theory, again, started sort of like after Pareto, but mostly developed in the Netherlands. They're not interested in drowning, so they look at extreme deviations for the sea levels. So that's the first fallacy of aggregation, is risks don't aggregate collectively from, you know, addition of small risks. So any one of us, okay, the probability of dying in a car accident is higher than any, you name it. But you, if it reverses, it's because it's Extremistan. Second fallacy of aggregation, and let's look at medicine. We started playing in a field called epidemiology, and we had fights with doctors. They tell me, hey, where did you get your medical degree? They think that you need to understand medicine to understand Extremistan. This is what we call the roulette fallacy, the carpenter fallacy. Who would you hire to understand probabilities in a roulette table, a carpenter or a probability person. So the more you're going to go into large deviation, the more you need a probability person. The more into small deviation, you need the carpenter. Well, here is the same. For N of one, it's a medical problem. Simple. For N higher than one, it is a statistical problem. And I don't know if you read papers in medicine, but they're all supervised and studied by statisticians. N of one is a case study. It's your own experience as a doctor or a case study in New England Journal of Medicine or something. Okay, so when you go higher than one, medical statistical problem, much higher than one is a purely statistical problem. The higher that number, the less you need to know about medicine and the more you need to know about statistical problems. And then when the N becomes very, very high, as I said, 800 million or something very large, it becomes a tail risk problem. So you see the ranking, clinical, medical, statistical, or scientific, evidence-based, and then as you go higher, becomes more and more a statistical problem, and more into the tails, extreme value statistics. So we're gonna look at the vaccine in that respect. But I summarize, is for large things, you start from the tail, you don't go from observation. You tell yourself, if you hear from Mars that 800,000 or 800 million people died, odds are it's gonna be a war or pandemic. Okay, so we know exactly, and it's the same thing for companies. We did it in, I'm still in finance, but I don't advertise it, but when I was in finance and did advertise it, we would always say, what will bankrupt me? And work backwards. You start with a tail. This is how you survive. Okay. Problem two, forecasting and growth rate. I wrote a paper again, a bunch of my friends working on promoting, you know, consciousness of extremes and understanding policy making associated with extreme. We had a fight with a fellow called Ioannidis, the most published man in medicine, the most published person in medicine. So, and he was arguing about forecasting. They say science is about forecasting. I said, no, you idiot, science is not about forecasting. And I'm gonna show you why. We said, not only that, someone produced a forecast, and he was criticizing the forecast because it didn't play out. A lot of people now are criticizing 10 Downing, you know, Boris Johnson, the fellow, in England. He likes good food, good wine, and parties. Anyway, they were forecasting some death, and then the forecast turned out to be wrong. And I said, those who forecast are idiots. I didn't put in these words in a scientific paper. We said, are idiots to say these forecasts were not justified. Something say unjustified forecasting means the guy forecasting is an idiot. Those who forecast were wrong, and those who criticize the forecast were also wrong. Why? Because you don't work with forecasting. This is a distribution typical of spreading of diseases, pandemic, of infectious diseases. The mean is 7, the average is 7. The most likely observation is 0.3. You see, what do you talk about forecasting? The most likely observation is 0.3. So the one who will win the forecasting game is the one who forecasts always 0.3. But the mean is 0.7. It's 7, sorry. So, forecast, you don't forecast, you work with probability distribution. There's another problem with forecasting. And we know that from social science, something is called self-canceling. Forecasting can be self-canceling. If I tell you I forecast a lot of death and you stay home, we're lucky, we're not gonna have a lot of death and I'm gonna be proven wrong. So you don't judge forecast by what happened later, but by the structure of the problem. They're either self-canceling or sometimes self-fulfilling. You see? So this is why you don't, in a dynamic environment, forecasting is for, you know, for psychologists who get involved in economic problems. Anyway. Problem number three, static versus dynamic. And this is a severe problem, particularly in Italy, because you guys have learned the word triage from your parents, from the French. And that conflicts with the history of the way the Mediterranean, the Roman Empire, the Mediterranean world thought. We'll see that later, but let's look at this first problem. A lot of people associate COVID with old age, because mortality from COVID appeared to be higher for older people. It's not. This is a force of mortality, and there's a multiplier. What is the force of mortality? This is it. You know, if you're 40, you have 1 in 400 chance, if you're a male in the United States, of dying. There's a gender gap here. Females are 730, 1 in 3700, okay? All what COVID did is multiply the number by 1.15. That's all it did, across the board. People who are 70 years old are more likely to die, okay, from COVID, but with the same proportion. It means this is not a young person's problem. Death is not a young person's problem. It just, and the argument saying the triage argument used in Italy, let's take care of the young, not the old, is inconsistent with the fact that we spend a lot of money on medicine and more people die of cancer when they're of old age. And it's inconsistent, okay, so this is the effect on life expectancy, because the young don't understand something called intergenerational commitment. That you don't take care of the old person because the person is old and you like old people. You take care of old people because you will be old. That's dynamic thinking. Why do you save for retirement? Okay? It means if you denigrate the elderly, it means you denigrate yourself, and what do you save for retirement? It's consistent. So we'll see that later with the gerontocide. But my point is framing, actually gerontocide is right now, but the framing, if you're gonna do it for COVID, do it for everything else. Stop spending money on medicine because it benefits the 85-year-old a lot more than it does the 40-year-old. But the reason I spend money on medicine for the 80-year-old is because I'm gonna be 80-year-old. I mean, I hope, I never know. You know, with the enemies I have, maybe not that likely, but so far, so good. I mean, find wood. Okay, so, but the error of reasoning, let's talk now about the Mediterranean, is as follows. Primitive societies, a society that's not very developed, have something called gerontocide, or senicide, okay? Meaning kill the old person. But in Mediterranean societies, and even in other societies, the minute the society becomes civilized, the minute they start worshiping the elderly. This is why the Chinese never complain about triage. I mean, never commit triage, or at least they don't say it if they do it. Because, I don't know if you know, the origin of the word senator comes from, of course, from the Latin, your language, okay? And in the Arabic language, you've heard the word, the title sheikh. No, sheikh, I don't know how to pronounce it in Italian. What does it mean in Arabic? It means old. Okay, so civilization starts when you start having dynamic judgment by its members with intergenerational commitment. I have no trouble if the Swedes The Swedes were the ones who wanted to let the all die of COVID. I had no problem with that. But then they should apply that everywhere, including Social Security and everything else. See, so because the civilization started with some rules, and one of them is the golden or the silver rule. I take care of the elderly because I want my children to take care of me. So that's intergenerational, like do to others what you want them, don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you, or do to others what you want them to do to you. Not the same others, that's a dynamic other. Okay. Problem four, disinformation, because there was disinformation. There still is disinformation. Actually, now that we are done with COVID, disinformation about the vaccine at many, many, many levels. So as a statistician, I can tell you one thing. For the class of risks that people are complaining about with the vaccine, they say, well, they're genetic modification. Space replaces time. And let me explain. How many people have been vaccinated? How many jabs have been given? Something like over 10 billion. 10 billion jabs. Okay? So you have a distribution of diseases. People think that if you're exposed to radiation, like as in Hiroshima or in Chernobyl, that you would develop cancer 15 years later, because on average people develop cancer 15 years later. Not true. There is a distribution. So when you have a lot of people, their sample size replaces time for matters that are genetic. So, and that's the effect of that distribution of the minima of time. So if on average it takes 12 years to develop a problem, when people complain about it, you say, oh, well, we need time, they're effectively complaining we don't have a larger sample. So let me explain it with a more intuitive example. If it takes you a billion years to develop a mutation, okay, to develop eight mutations, say that was necessary to have cancer, okay, on average, it takes, so if having a billion people for 1 year is equivalent to one person for a billion years. So you can transfer time into space with that. So and that is what people don't get to criticize our vaccines, because effectively, without the vaccines, you know, it's not that vaccines are entertaining or good, you know, because it tastes good, but we have no choice. So this is one disinformation that we debunked by saying a very large sample is equivalent to having something for a very long time. And it applies to any disease, okay, pretty much anything that has to do with genetics. And they're complaining about genetics. Another one is they make mistakes by showing you statistics that miss on central stuff. Forget about the math here, I'll hide it. But there was a mistake commonly circulating showing you that people who are vaccinated in all age groups had a higher rate of death in total than unvaccinated. And they don't get it, that something called Simpson's paradox is those who are vaccinated on average are older. And as you know from visiting, from going to funerals, typically people who die are what? They're older. So if on average those who die are older, and if on average the older are more vaccinated, so therefore, the vaccinated are going to have a higher rate of death than unvaccinated. That's Simpson's paradox. So we need to clean it up from the data. But the propaganda machine was putting in the head of a lot of people, okay, that you shouldn't vaccinate because it's bad for your health, and look at these numbers. And these keep circulating. I know of these things, I got involved, especially on Twitter, because a certain person called me up. They said, listen, PBS, you know, which is a public television, and the New York Times, they're moralizing. They're like an old uncle. No, nobody likes them. So nobody listened to them. But you're known to be an asshole, right? So people trust you. So why don't you help me out in debunking these claims? So this is how I started getting involved in debunking claims on COVID, hence this thing. Problema cinque. It was actually a pun in English. Mascara is mask in English, but masquerade in English, in mask in Italian, but masquerade means, I don't know how to translate masquerade into Italian, but it's masquerade is something fake. So people, I wrote something about face cover. In the beginning, a lot of anti-mask people did not understand nonlinearity. It's the very same nonlinearity. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. They tell you where we don't have evidence that masks work. So say, I have no evidence that this water is poison, but why don't you drink it? Or I have no evidence that pilot is definitely drunk. Okay. I have no evidence that I'm going to have an accident, but I put my seatbelt. So there are some things you do precautionarily beyond the evidence, and that's entirely scientific. But the same nonlinearity here also applies to masks, where they didn't realize the following. Two things. The first one is that if I have a mask and you have a mask, and I've reduced my risk by 25%, and you have a mask, the total risk doesn't go down by 25%, it compounds. So two masks compound the protection. The second nonlinearity, and that's central, is that if I lower the viral load by 10%, I don't lower the risk by 10%. I may lower the risk by 99%. Just a little bit of lowering of the viral load, because everything in nature is nonlinear, usually following that famous S-curve. That's another point that people were not getting. So, but that one is, I'm not going against the right or the left. That was made by the UN Geneva in the beginning, okay? That mistake on masks. They didn't really understand two things about masks. One, the nonlinearity of evidence or asymmetry, and the other one, the nonlinearity of the effect. And then we wrote papers on masks. All of these, there's a collection of papers. You can find, maybe I'll give a link, of 8 to 9 papers, one on mask, one debunking studies on masks, one debunking a bunch of things. A lot of them published in journals just to annoy epidemiologists in big journals. Anyway, so let me talk now about interlocking fragility. You've heard of something called inflazione, no? Inflation. Let's talk about it. If I have year one, a consumption of 5, then year two, a consumption of 95, that's a nonlinearity I cover in antifragile. You're gonna be a lot worse off than having 50 than 50. That's a nonlinearity. So if you have very little demand, okay, and then a lot of demand to compensate, you're gonna have an explosion in prices. Another 7 or 8 minutes, and then I'm done. Okay, I'm following. So, what's happening in our world is that the world is much more reactive to this that comes from fragility. Fragility, as the His Excellency the Rector has mentioned, an anti-fragility is prevalent. So, and is increasing with time. So you need to become to compensate more anti-fragile, more robust at least. So, and effectively we can see that the world is becoming more prone to these unevenness, more fragile. Every once in a while, that was in 2017, The Economist comes back with the same story. It discovers that natural catastrophes have probably barely changed in frequency, but the effect on GDP is bigger and bigger. So for example, Tokyo had an earthquake in 1924, and then Kobe had an earthquake, 1994, something like that. you can calculate that the Kobe, had it happened in Tokyo, would have been vastly worse than worldwide than 1924. We're becoming, that comes with globalization. That's not a problem, but you need to know it. So, my concept is that the market's like a large movie theater with a small door. And the best way to detect an idiot is to see his focus on the size of the theater, not the size of the door. Okay. So when you watch for things, or sucker, the taquino. So this is the evidence that, and actually I discussed that in the Black Swan. The Black Swan written 2008. The Economist had a thing up till, the Black Swan was written 2006, up till 2005. So the trend has been more and more pronounced and discussed every year. Another nonlinearity is that we have, in our society today, have developed a pathological risk aversion. The reasons planes don't crash, nobody argues, hey, we're spending so much money to prevent planes from crashing. I don't know, you know how much money we're spending? A huge amount of money. It's because of the sensationalism of a plane crash. And then you also have labor laws, and then you also have the sensationalism of this room falling on us. Nobody complained about that during COVID because of disinformation. But our society is getting more and more risk averse, so it does not tolerate small risks, which is why you have better buildings. Every time a building collapses, the next building is anti-fragile, will be, some poor people die, but the next one will be safer. So the communities will be safer. Every time a plane crashes, the next plane ride will be safer. Because we're focusing on it. And because we have laws now protecting. That didn't apply to COVID. But this risk aversion is pretty much something that is gonna increase in society. So projecting for the future, you're not gonna take it away because you become inconsistent. Say, oh, we're gonna let people die from COVID, but hey, no, let's spend a lot of money to prevent plane crashes. And actually, I don't know if you know, but in a plane, you're so safe, you're probably safer than in your living room. Particularly if you're building, your living room building was built in the 60s. Finalmente. How did our ancestors understood pandemics? They did prune a network with this called a lazaretto. So they did not do lockdowns by locking you in your house. They were wise enough to see it coming and react very, very quickly. Paranoia is the best asset we have. Always cheaper to be paranoid early, not late. So that's what we have to learn from the ancestors, is that look at Lazaretto. The minute they suspected anything, and they made you spend 40 days there, you imagine they had no web, no TV. You're spending 40 days in a room. Actually, it was not the quarantine. It was not always 40 days. From the Ottoman Empire, it was 11 days. But still, 11 days with strangers. But guess what? Was Trump? They did not check, they were doing lockdowns, but the federal US government waited 13 months into a pandemic until Biden came to power before doing a checking passengers for, requiring a PCR test for passengers coming in the country. 13 months. You don't need to do a quarantine if you have a COVID. They didn't have, the Ottomans or the Habsburg and all these people and the Venetians, unfortunately, didn't have PCR tests at the time. So they had to have this. And people put up with it and nobody complained for 500 years. 500 years, nobody complained, okay? So it was not till Biden came to power that we had, checking at US border. So finally, success and failures. Just imagine having had COVID, but we didn't have the internet. Okay, imagine that. And then the other thing is, now that we know what COVID does not give you immunity. Just imagine if we didn't have the vaccine. Thank you for listening to me.
So, grazie, grazie Nassim. You can have a seat there. And I am now inviting the director of La Stampa. E adesso basta inglese, mi sono un attimo distratto, sono continuato, ero tutto concentrato per cercare di comprendere quello che ci diceva il dottor Taleb. Io chiedo appunto al dottor Giannini di venire sul podio per una intervista a Nassim Taleb che durerà 15-20 minuti per consentirci di fare una pausa in vista dell'evento poi delle 9 che sarà lo spettacolo di Paolini e Pievani. Grazie e buona intervista.
Grazie, grazie al Rettore Saracco, grazie a voi tutti, grazie alla Biennale Tecnologia, è ragione di orgoglio poter partecipare ad eventi come questi in questa città. Ha ragione il Rettore, Torino si sta davvero rilanciando come un vero laboratorio da molti punti di vista, quindi siamo molto molto contenti di essere qui questa sera con Nassim Taleb, grazie, l'ho ascoltata con straordinaria attenzione per tutte le suggestioni che ci ha regalato, facciamo una conversazione rapida per provare a tirare qualche somma di tutto quello che lei ci ha detto, io per parte mia aggiungerò qualche curiosità ulteriore. La prima cosa che vorrei chiederle, quindi, riflettendo sul tema delle pandemie, in particolare del Covid, non è un cigno nero il Covid, giusto Taleb? Non è un cigno nero, nel senso che era statisticamente raro, ma tutto sommato prevedibile, giusto? Se non ho capito male la sua indicazione.
Again, was COVID the black swan? It depends, as Luca said, it depends, are you the turkey or are you the butcher? Okay. So the thing about the black swan is that people want a clear definition of the black swan. So let's talk about Putin's invasion. It was probably a black swan for people sitting in their living room watching television, but it was not for people in Ukraine, and definitely not for the CIA. Okay, so these events, but what we have to do is understand not events, but structures of problems, as I was talking about, and classes of risks. Risks we should take seriously, and risks that take care of themselves. We should take as seriously risks of pandemics as we do with risks of plane crashes or risks coming from bad construction.
Ecco, quali sono però gli errori che abbiamo commesso nella gestione delle pandemie? E quali sono le lezioni che ci portiamo dietro di fronte all'evento che si potrà ripetere con tutta evidenza?
I think that His Excellency the Rector discussed anti-fragility. And I believe that we're going to face the next pandemic. We're going to be better off provided now we address those people who say, oh, we overreacted. How do you know we overreacted? Okay, because we don't have a good counterfactual. If had we not reacted at all, we probably would not be here. Okay, so but I'm sure these people are just young and stupid and vocal, but the future in the future would be able to handle the next pandemic more effectively. We know the way, so we've learned from it, both at the economic level and at healthcare level, and of course at a political level. Okay, we know a lot more about these classes of risk. We know how to handle the next one, and it's very bad. They say 6 million died, but the real number is probably closer to 20. So say 20, that's bad, 20 million people dying. But that probably would prevent the next one. Assume that COVID was something like a generalized Ebola, okay? Or something even worse, something escaping an antibiotic resistance bacteria, something escaping from hospitals, for example. And we're starting to develop a lot of those in hospitals as breeding ground. So had we had that first, we would have been in trouble. But now we're better equipped. Plus, we're very lucky we had the web. There's a Talmudic saying that God gives you the cure first and then the disease later. So think about, we had the internet first and COVID. Much better than having had COVID first than the internet. Okay.
Senta, professor Taleb, mi colpiva molto che lei accennava al modo differente con il quale abbiamo trattato e curato le persone, no? Il triage che è un principio non soltanto italiano. Lei addirittura parlava di gerontocidio. Vuol dire che ci siamo concentrati troppo sui giovani. Sulla considerazione che in fondo gli anziani ormai erano, diciamo, a fine corsa, posso dirla in maniera un po' brutale, salvo che questo principio, almeno in Italia, fa a pugni, e lei lo ha accennato, con una gestione del nostro welfare che è esattamente opposto, no? Perché in Italia il grosso della spesa sociale è concentrata sulle pensioni, e sui giovani si fa poco e niente, il che è piuttosto stupefacente dal punto di vista dell'inversione logica. Lei vede questo come un problema solo italiano, oppure è diffuso a tutto l'Occidente, che vive peraltro un drammatico fenomeno di calo demografico?
Okay, first the word triage, you got it from the French, like very bad things, you get them from the French, typically. And if something has an Italian origin, it's a good thing. If it's a French origin, I'm just too annoying. It's not as good. So they're not okay. I would say that I frankly think that triage is a crime, and geronticide is a crime, and Northern Europe doesn't have the depths of civilization that you have here. I apologize for those who may be offended, but it's truth, okay, that you partake here of an ancient Mediterranean culture that is based on some principles that were violated a little bit during COVID with this triage. But now you're asking me about the young. Why would the young put up with the fact that we have an aging of the population? I tell them that's life, because you're going to be old one day, and you may have even more aging of the population when you're going to be older. That's how it works. It's dynamic. And the sign of maturity for a civilization is to think in terms of second order effects, not simple effects. Second order effects, things move, right? Things are not that simple. These simplifications are dramatically misleading. So to me, it's a non-problem, because, you know, you have golden rules. You treat others like you'd like to be treated, and well, unless you want to be treated poorly. The young accept today to sign papers saying would like to be left to die on the side of the road the minute we turn 81¾. That's it. If they sign that paper and they're committed to it and they can't change their mind later, then we can talk about subsidizing the elderly and stuff like that.
Voglio farle una domanda ancora sempre a proposito delle pandemie che riguarda i decisori politici. Lei faceva cenno prima all'esperienza statunitense e ricordava come ci sono voluti 13 mesi prima che arrivasse Biden e introducesse i controlli.
13, not 30.
Sì. La domanda è questa.
13.
La domanda è questa. Secondo lei questo da cosa nasce? C'è una sorta di pregiudizio antiscientifico nel ceto politico? Perché non è solo un fatto americano. Noi, per esempio, in Italia in questa fase viviamo un momento di grande tensione, di grande polemica, perché c'è l'idea che tutto quello che è stato fatto in passato, l'Italia è stata molto rigorosa nella gestione dei controlli, ecco, vada archiviato in fretta.
Okay, so let me talk about the cluster, what I call the cluster. A class of people, they were anti-masks, anti-vaccines, Putin supporters, the libertarian for the U.S. They don't understand actually the spirit of libertarianism because they cite von Hayek and von Mises. Von Mises, a libertarian, but he wants the state. He said, we need the state for some things. We just want them out of business. Okay. That the state's role is precisely in defense. And Hayek use explicitly the word epidemics. The state is there to manage deforestation, epidemics, stuff like that. It's von Hayek. So libertarians, for some reason, they were against these measures, okay? Maybe it's financed somewhere, but we'll get to that. So we have a cluster, anti-vax, anti-masks, sometimes outright COVID deniers by saying, hey, you know, COVID is for fat people, and therefore, okay. Pro-Putin. What else? Pro-Bitcoin. Sometimes meat eaters only. So you find that cluster. So I was wondering, how did that happen? I have about 900,000 people on social media, And of course, when you have many people like that, become a target, so you can identify what was going on. And then one day, I start being attacked on inflation. And also, they believe the Bitcoin, that the states are creating inflation, stuff like that. And then I have this anecdote that's going to lead us to the source. Someone, Linda from Texas, was complaining on my anti-Bitcoin feed on inflation. Bitcoin would solve inflation. That's what they believed at the time. But she used a ruble sign to talk about dollars. So this Linda from Texas is some big guy called Boris, full of tattoos in St. Petersburg in a building, who has about 10 to 12 roles. And it turned out that a lot of them would organize meetings, town hall meetings in the United States without leaving Russia. Because they penetrate fishing groups, they go fishing and stuff like that. And a lot of people who fish may be libertarian. So they penetrated all these naive people. So I was wondering what was going on, being the target myself by these people. So I knew that some Russians were involved until it was explained to me that the thing is very old. You remember the big scientist Carl Sagan? Carl Sagan went 29 times on national TV in the U.S. promoting the idea of nuclear winter based on scientific research. Guess who was the source of that scientific research? The KGB. So let me explain how it all started. You know, the KGB was very, very good early on after the first war, or the second war, when they got the, you know, instead of doing research, they had some spies and they got the nuclear bomb with help from a bunch of traitors. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan wanted to, you remember when Ronald Reagan wanted to put nuclear missiles in Germany? There was a green movement in Germany that erupted against him, against that project. Guess who started it? Now we have documents. The KGB. The KGB started that, so they discovered one thing, that the KGB was much better at disinformation, spreading disinformation, than gathering information. So, who was in at the time in East Germany? Vladimir Vladimirovich. He was there. So they discovered, and probably that it was much more effective to play on the internet than to send spies. But you know that Carl Sagan was innocent, but they planted some things. So there's nothing, you know, it's a very bad idea to have nuclear, you know, if you can do something else, right, if you have the option. The problem is that they wanted the West to be green, anti-nuclear, but they wanted Russia to keep building their nuclear arsenal, right? So this is where this all started. And now we see more and more disinformation. There was disinformation that's blatant against the vaccine in the U.S., anything that causes people to have a distrust of their government was exploited. So that's what happened during that period. Anything that makes you distrust the government. So they find these people who have a teenage problem, they're 40 years old and still have a teenage problem, and plant in their head the hatred that the government, there's this conspiracy, large conspiracy, of people trying to control your life with vaccines and all these things. And it's the same, it's a cluster. So libertarians in the US love Putin, okay? And then we have Snowden defending liberty in California, based where? In Moscow. Now, if a group decided to defend to promote the equality of women in Italy, and that group was based in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, wouldn't you ask some questions? But nobody was wondering why is Snowden in Russia, okay? Well, he's you know, it's because people became, are very naive, and if their friends don't doubt it, they don't doubt it, and anytime you doubt Snowden in Russia, you get swamped by 5,000 trolls out of Moscow, out of St. Petersburg. So disinformation, I think, played a large role, but I think it's more and more under control now.
Ecco, però mi ricollego proprio a questo, la disinformazione che credo sia un tema gigantesco e che incrocia tutti i drammatici problemi che l'umanità in questo momento si trova di fronte, perché appunto andiamo dalla pandemia alla guerra all'economia. Da questo punto di vista il web, che è stato un formidabile acceleratore delle libertà e della democrazia, si porta però dietro anche un gigantesco pericolo, perché la disinformazione transita soprattutto sulla rete, no? Allora, la domanda che le faccio è questa, duplice: da un lato, appunto, che tipo di vigilanza si può esercitare da questo punto di vista, e da un altro punto di vista, se guardiamo quello che sta succedendo, per esempio su Twitter con Elon Musk, che l'ha comprata, e il suo approccio è piuttosto aggressivo, e uso un termine un po' riduttivo, anche rispetto ai diritti, se vogliamo. Ecco, noi non rischiamo, anche da questo punto di vista, di ritrovarci in un mondo sotto il profilo della rete e quindi della, democratizzazione del sapere, in cui da un lato abbiamo la disinformazione sulla quale è difficile esercitare controlli e dall'altro un capitalismo della sorveglianza che appunto attraverso l'emergere di questi personaggi che hanno un fatturato che supera il PIL di intere nazioni, okay, si profilano come tiranni a loro volta.
Ok. So I'm writing a piece now that has these things outside the incerto, because it's not as playful. And I'm going to tell you one thing I've noticed. I call it the Tocqueville effect, because it's similar to something Tocqueville detected. At no point in time did we have more gender equality in history, okay? Or at least in recorded history. At no point in time did we have more fairness. At no point in time have we complained more about fairness, gender inequality, racism, and all these things. Okay. Let me continue about transparency. At no point in time have we had more transparency in the United States. Okay. The smartest piece actually is a brilliant man, Umberto Eco. People underestimate Umberto Eco. Smartest piece is when he's talking about conspiracy theorists, okay, by saying, you cannot, there's a rule of silence, okay, that people can't, he knows human nature, he said people like to talk, so eventually we'll end up knowing everything. So if there's a conspiracy, you'd know about it. And the example he gave was, he said Diana died, and every single person who transited through her bed got 400,000 euros equivalent to write a book. So he said, and we know it's been much more for her mother-in-law. Okay, so much more money. So he said, eventually we end up knowing everything. So, and we have more transparency now because book deals and stuff. So, at no point in time, I don't know if you know the period in the 60s in the United States when we had J. Edgar Hoover running the FBI. Boy, that was a dark period, but we know it now. So we're nowhere near that, yet the perception today of state intrusion, of surveillance, has never been higher. And believe me, I work with large data, okay? If the state is exerting any surveillance, they're not good at it, okay? Because they're not seeing anything that matters, so. And if internet companies that have some surveillance, they're lucky if they can predict what toothpaste you're gonna buy next week. They're lucky. And they actually anonymize. So really, I don't think it's very consequential. But there's one thing I'd like, the other point I'd like to discuss is, are we so different from the past? In my opinion, we're not much more polarized than the past, and we don't have much more disinformation than the past, except we know about disinformation. I saw that ruble sign, you know, that Linda in Texas, you know, addressing and putting a ruble sign, so knowing fat guy Boris in St. Petersburg. There's a building, actually, where we know. So we know more about this information. I'm not very familiar with Italian history. I mean, I'd like to, because emotionally I love Italy. But I know more about the period in France when you really had this information during the French Revolution. I don't know if you remember the Collier de la Reine, the necklace of Marie, all the things circulating about Marie Antoinette. And at a time, you had Vladimir Putin sitting in, Vladimir Vladimirovich sitting in London and helping these printers print what they call the libels. You know, where they were explaining how Marie Antoinette would sleep with the butcher, and have all these kind of things circulating, and there was no monitoring. So in my opinion, it was vastly worse then. I mean, it brought the French Revolution. So I think that we're just better at figuring out problems. We live in a society that is extremely self-correcting. So you have a Snowden, okay, it was a footnote, like he couldn't find anything worse, right? So it's a very self-correcting society. We discover problems, we have whistleblowers, we improve. And then we go next, and we're going to be better. So every time. So I'm not worried about our society. I'm just would like you to know that the perception is often out of sync was reality. So we have a perception of disinformation, whereas we have less than before. I was like an idiot believing in, they had all, in this theory of the nuclear winter, and the KGB, it was a paper that was initiated by the KGB that everybody was citing, and that paper did not exist, okay? There was a study that did not exist, okay? Today, you can catch that in 10 minutes if you have Google, right? So,
ultima domanda, perché il tempo purtroppo è scaduto, staremo ore a discutere e a ragionare con Nassim Taleb. Lei ha annunciato in un'intervista che ha fatto al nostro giornale qualche giorno fa che sta lavorando a un nuovo pamphlet virus, guerre e monete, in cui affronterà il tema anche della globalizzazione. La domanda che le faccio è questa: dopo la pandemia e anche dopo, sarebbe meglio dire durante la guerra in Ucraina, lei non teme che il rischio per il nostro mondo, io lo definisco tale, è che si esca da queste esperienze con la cosiddetta deglobalizzazione, cioè il mondo e le società aperte, okay, alla luce di quello che è accaduto, tendano a richiudersi?
Again, I mean, I said we live in a self-correcting society, and the proof of it is you're inviting someone like me here, all right, so I can be heard. So visibly, it's a self-correcting society. So what is, now what is, the story with globalization? We had, you see the effect, the 5 and 95 were very vulnerable to unevenness. People had factories in China. I know Coca-Cola, don't cite me on it, a certain US firm, progressively started concentrating in China because it's cheaper. Over time, you get lulled in a sense of security. And of course, they got hurt. Now, guess what? They looked at the map and say, what? There's a country here called Argentina, Chile, India. Apple's going to India. So let me give you one number. At no point in time have I heard people complaining more about globalization and say it's the end of globalization. You read the end of globalization papers. Look at the data. The BIS revealed that we had the highest rate, you know, the globalization as of 3 months ago was the highest ever. So it increased. It's transferring. It's being distributed away from China. So you have more stuff with other countries, and we love China, but you'd like to also do business with India. So more, but globalization today is higher than pre-COVID. And now people, it's the same thing with racial inequality and unfairness and all of that. The more you hear people complaining about it and calling for the end of it, the more we globalize, but more intelligently. There are systems that are benign, self-correcting, and there are systems that are dangerously self-feeding, right? We are self-correcting. So I am not worried about globalization. I mean, look at the data from the BIS. I mean, all this talk, I look at data. I'm a statistician. I look at data. It's not in the data. So maybe Italian firms now have discovered, I don't know, that there is a map of their countries. There's a country called Malaysia, Indonesia, Mongolia, this, right? And then the other thing is, a lot of people are talking about Russia. I mean, Russia represents hardly anything of world trade. And let me talk now, close with something about anti-fragile that the rector likes. The best gift we had is for Putin to get the gas now. You see these young kids? It's not by going out on a stage that you're going to get energy independence and clean energy. It's with shocks like these. I don't know if you remember, those of you who were, many, many were not born, and some were there, 1973. The Arabs had the brilliant idea to raise prices. What happened? They caused a glut of oil by 1980, all right? They caused a glut because we're not aware of energy independence. Start having, you know, American cars at a time. You can have a party in an American car, okay? And then American cars got smaller, speed limits on a highway. Italian cars started small, got even smaller. And then you had timers in bathrooms in Paris, You don't have time to wash your hands. Energy consumption dropped like a rock. Okay? And nobody felt anything. It was no drop in lifestyle. And then by 1980, actually, it bankrupted the Soviet Union. So now we're going to have the same thing, but what happened in the 90s, where did we mess up? We didn't have an energy policy because we weren't aware of the climate thing. So after the oil, Texas went bankrupt. Saudi Arabia was nearly bust in the 80s. The Soviet Union went bust on low oil simply because we adapted very quickly. So Putin is forcing us to adapt now. Guess what? In the 90s, we didn't have an energy policy, so we started getting gas guzzlers. This time, it's not going to happen. Now people are getting bicycles and enjoying it. So I think, in much more positive terms, that what we've learned from both COVID and the war in Ukraine is actually going to help us a lot in the future.
Bene. Abbiamo provato a fare diventare pessimista Nassim Taleb, ma non ci siamo riusciti, ma è quello che ci piace di lui. Grazie, grazie mille.